Welcome to Cybersecurity Insights, the podcast for the cybered.io learning community. Our goal is to bring cybersecurity practitioners the latest and most relevant education and training to upskill and dive deeper into topics that matter in today's modern cybersecurity world.
Good day, everyone. This is Steve King. I'm the managing director for cybered.io, and today we have the pleasure of Dr. Chase Cunningham's company on the podcast, and Dr. Chase is here to talk about, I hope, his new book called How Not to Lead, that's about to be published by Wiley and Company. I think the publication date is January 24th, and it's a fascinating read, not just for cybersecurity folks, but for everybody in our audience who may not be practitioners or in the space, because it has little to do, in my mind, with cybersecurity and everything to do with leadership in business and probably outside of business as well. And there are great stories and great chapters and good stuff for everybody, no matter what they're doing. Those of you who aren't yet familiar with Dr. Cunningham, he's also known in the industry as Dr. Zero Trust. He was the creator of the Zero Trust Extended framework at Forrester, I believe, and was a cybersecurity expert with deep experience across all aspects of enterprise security, and worked at NSA, Navy, FBI, Cyber Division, other government mission critical groups. He was recently a chief strategy officer for Ericom Software. He was the VP of security market research at G2, and in addition to his service as a Forrester analyst. So he began, I think, in the Navy as a chief cryptologic technician, doing that weird magic stuff with cryptology, and has been the director of threat intelligence for companies like Arma, and director of cyber analytics for Decisive Analytics, and has written a few books now, Riptide, Gabriel, Cyber Warfare, Truth Tactics and Strategies. Gabriel is we'll call it a nonfiction book, but
fiction-ish.
Yeah. Sorry, fiction-ish book is what. Thank you.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And it's and who knows? It's so much. It's a day-to-day thing. We'll see, but it's very entertaining for those that enjoy military,
like thriller type stuff,
thriller mystery. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So welcome, Chase. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It kind of reminds me I've been doing too much lately. Hearing you say all that.
Well, you do a lot. You have an amazing current career in addition to your past career. So let's talk about, one of the chapters here is called Proof is in the Pudding. I think it's the last chapter.
Yep.
Talks about a company that I know a little bit about, ThreatLocker. And instead of the focus being on how not to lead, ThreatLocker is a great example of a company who should be a template for how to lead. And in particular, this is going to go to folks that, are in the cybersecurity space, because, the way they ran their company, of course, is going to be familiar to or dissimilar to folks that are running cybersecurity companies. So why don't we start by telling us a little bit about ThreatLocker and your experience of them and why you think it's such a well-run company?
Yeah, I referenced two companies in there just because I never wanted to leave. I find a lot of books that I've read, because I spend a lot of time reading like self-help and business and whatever else books. If I'm not doing cyber work, I'm probably reading a book along those lines. But a lot of them kind of leave you hanging with, well, where's an example of, the fix or the right way to do this? And for me, having intimate knowledge of the folks at ThreatLocker and the folks at Lumu were the two that I put in that chapter. And the reason that made so much sense to me is that a lot of where we see folks in technology and in cyber specifically kind of going wrong, those companies went pretty orthogonal to the current mantra of come up with an idea, get some angels, raise money, and then hopefully sell as fast as possible, and you devalue the hell out of what you're doing financially, and it causes a lot of pain for everybody just because they're dealing with VCs and the other side of the equation. So these companies have done a good job of really sticking to their guns and following along with their approach, and they've kind of been in that space of, we're going to succeed, and we're going to succeed the way that we know that this is going to work. And if someone wants to tag along and benefit from that success, great. But they're really good examples, in my opinion, of companies that don't fit the mold that have done exceptionally well and are continuing to do well. You know, Danny at ThreatLocker, I've known Danny for, gosh, quite a long time now. And he and I were in an accelerator together. And I remember literally people on day one of the accelerator telling Danny, you can't run a company with your wife as the COO. And Danny was like, I don't care. That's my wife. I trust her. We're going to do this our way. And sure enough, Danny's unicorn valuation with his wife and his brother as members of the executive team. Sort of similar-ish with Lumu, where Ricardo was told by all kinds of people, like, you can't build a business doing cybersecurity focusing on Latin America. And RV was, he goes by RV. He said, no, we can, and watch. And his business does a lot of business in Latin America because no one else would kind of pay attention to that market. And it's just really good examples of smart people that have the intestinal fortitude to know they're doing something different and then continually find ways to succeed.
Yeah, it validates my premise at one of my startups where my wife was the CMO and did a great job as the marketing chief marketing officer for 3 years for us before we exited. And I don't think that would have been possible without her either. So, yeah, your chapter one talks about the value of knowing what not to do. Can you elaborate on why that's, we spend a lot of time on here's what to do, here's the way you get from A to B, but we don't ever rarely talk about the things not to do.
Yeah, I think for me personally, and I made sure to write in this book, like every chapter kind of starts out with either a personal story or someone that I've known that's been through something. The first chapter for me talks about when I was a kid and was growing up on a farm or a ranch in Texas, learning a very valuable lesson of what not to do from a ranch hand. And basically, he told me the right way to do things and what to avoid doing. And me being the super intelligent person I am, ignored everything he said. And sure enough, it led to misery for me for days on end. And further on into that chapter, I did a lot of research looking at Steve Jobs is always kind of seen as, you know, the pinnacle of innovation and whatever else. And rightfully so, he's done a lot of great stuff. But what I found was really interesting was Steve made some super categorical changes at Apple based on literally him writing on a whiteboard, here's what we're not doing anymore, when he came back to Apple. And that really turned the company around and ultimately kind of changed the course of technology and human history. So the value of knowing what not to do, in my opinion, and I think my research kind of validates this, is as valuable, if not possibly more valuable, than trying to figure out what's the right thing to do all the time. I think your gut kind of tells you a lot of times what the right thing to do, or your brain will if you actually do some analysis. But like having the insight from people that are telling you don't do these things can save you so much misery and heartache. And in the world of business, you're always looking for an edge. If I know what not to do from others, then that is my edge and I can run with that. And it's a simplistic value proposition for those of us that are trying to gain and grow and succeed.
Yeah, no kidding. I guess pushing that cap up that chute is taught you several good lessons, didn't it?
Yeah, I found out what corral dirt tastes like, which I would not recommend to anybody.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think there were 22 projects all going on at the same time, in your reference to Jobs and Apple, and super smart and prescient of him to kill them all.
He just literally came in and said, all of this is gone. We're not doing that anymore. And of course,
and they're all good ideas, But the thing that was remarkable about Jobs in my mind, among other things, as you point out, is that he has this innate ability to know stuff that he shouldn't know at his age, you know. I don't know where that comes from, but his view of, you know, when you start a product design and you commit to it, by the time you get to the actual design of the product, it's changed like 47 times and it takes 25 times longer than you thought, right? And maybe he did that once and learned that. It's taken me like, I don't know, 12 times to learn that. Because even today I say, hey, that's a great idea. Let's think about it. You know? And I'm like, no, stop, right? Let's just do the one thing that we're doing and focus on that. So then in chapter two, you talk about currencies that matter as a leader. Can you describe those for us?
Yeah, so I think what came out to me was that what are the currencies that really you should be focused on? And then is there a kind of a bank or a way to store or spend those currencies? And I did some research and some surveys and came out with really the three that matter most in this context are time, respect, and trust. And when you kind of think about it, time seems like something that people don't give enough value to. And that came out in the research as well, is that a lot of leaders will, not really realizing it, take time from people, from families, from home, from all kinds of things. And it just continually degrades the other two things, which are respect and trust for those people. Because if I'm your employee and I know that every time some event comes up, you're going to start lining me up to take my time away based on whatever reasoning you have, my respect and trust for you starts to be affected. And it's this, you know, kind of vicious cycle that continues to go on. And the follow on to that was really being able to make sure that you keep a bank of respect and trust with your employees and the people you work with. You spend it. Most people spend it without really thinking about the fact that you're constantly draining that account. You've got to keep a plus. You want your numbers in the black for respect and trust with people, because it's a commodity that is super crucial and critical, and it is ever dripping out of that account. So it was just very validating for me to see that people did value these things differently based on what was actually most critical to them.
And what's the most valuable currency?
So trust actually is the most valuable currency that came out. And the funny thing is that seems pretty logical. Like, actually, when I got the results from my surveys, it was kind of like, duh. But the follow-on from that was, well, how do you build trust? Trust actually, in this context, is an equation. It's a result of the addition of value from respect and the time that you work to give people to be themselves and do their own things. Trust is like the old saying about trust is earned is never more true in this particular approach.
Yeah, no kidding. One of your chapters talks about deserving what you tolerate, and as we look around the real world, we can see the consequences of that statement. Can you elaborate a little bit about what you mean by?
Yeah. So the quote actually from that I got from one of my chief's friends was, "You get what you expect, and you deserve what you tolerate." And deserving what you tolerate is actually something where a lot of people will kind of knee jerk react and go, "Well, that's not." Nice to say, but in reality, if you think about it, and the point I was trying to make in this chapter is you do deserve it, and you should expect to kind of get what you're putting into something. If you're allowing people to disrespect you as a leader, you're going to get disrespected, and you deserve it. And the only way to fix that is to address the problem head on. Like you said, I think currently today we kind of live in a world where it's more super soft skills rather than folks being willing to kind of confront things face to face and say, this is how we fix this. But if you don't actually deal with it and be real about it, you're never going to get past that. And you should expect as a leader that, you know, whatever you tolerate will be the outcome that's going to happen. If you let people sliding by is going to be the constant that occurs. And it's interesting too, over time, that level of tolerance that you apply or give people only kind of continues to propagate that behavior. If you don't nip it in the bud quickly, then you will have more of it, and it just becomes compounding interest on a problem.
Yeah, exactly. And we should all grow up on a farm in Texas also. You talk about flat organizations and flat fail. What's the correlation there?
Yeah, so I was really interested in that one because I've worked at and consulted a lot of organizations that really preach about their flat structure. And what was funny was when you go through references and do the research on kind of what's published, most of the organizations that were truly flat abandoned that approach because they found out real quickly it's a great idea to have this kind of kumbaya, let's, you know, rally around the fire and everybody's on the same level thing. But in a business, organizationally, it doesn't work. You're going to have someone somewhere that can make a call and push things forward. There's got to be some driver, somebody in charge. And it doesn't mean that you have to have a crazy draconian, you know, only do what I say type of thing. But the flat side of this only causes problems. And actually what happens is you get a lot of what I call in the book, like mommy, daddy speak, where people are kind of playing leaders off of each other to get what they want. It is absolutely antithetical, orthogonal to being able to execute on objectives. And that's not going to work for a business.
What's a dumpster chicken?
So a dumpster chicken, in the Navy, we call them dumpster chickens. But if you've ever been to a pier, you'll see them flying around the dumpsters. It's seagulls, really. And the thing that I was trying to get across there is if you're a dumpster chicken, some people might call them helicopter leaders, where essentially you squawk and call from on high, then you'll fly in everywhere, take a crap on whatever everybody's doing, and then fly away. That's not actually helpful. You might think that it's a good way to kind of align on the problem and let everybody know that you understand the issue. But if you're going to be a dumpster chicken, back to kind of deserving what you tolerate, you should expect that people are not going to want to put up with that very long. And it's going to be harder to actually get things done. You've got to be involved and engaged, but you don't want to only be involved and engaged for like this minimal amount of time. Nobody likes their boss to come by and say something over their shoulder and just keep on walking. If you're going to tell me that you've identified a problem, then at least provide me with some avenue of fix. Otherwise, you're just adding to the problem.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of advice that's been thrown around, you know, the Valley in particular about go fast and break things, etc. You have a chapter called Go Slow and Be Fast, or To Be Fast. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I got exposed to that doing military operations with different special forces units. And really what you hear there is if you look at, you know, Navy SEAL mantra and ethos and 75th Rangers and whatever, they talk about slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And most of the time in cyber, or technology really, we push, innovate, shove things down the throat of whoever's willing to buy it. And then we go back and we kind of fix the outcome on the far end. It sounds like an okay idea, but when you actually look at the data and the research across time, that causes more problems than it fixes. So the smart thing is to say, we understand where we're trying to go. Let's be systematic and intelligent and tactical about what we're doing, but we're not going to just rush, because you wind up coming back and fixing a lot of the problems that you introduced with speed. And speed in some instances can kill, and you don't want speed killing your business. And it's hard to get somebody to go, okay, let's slow down. But the research and from my own experience working with companies, most of the time that becomes the best thing that an organization do is say, let's take a pause and let's just really cautiously think about where we're going and what we're doing.
Yeah, that brings me to a chapter that illustrates a shared experience that you and I have had related to Norse and Mary Landesman. Talk to us about Norse and your view of, you know, what, I mean, to me, they're like the captain obvious of what not to do in business, but
yeah, I mean, yeah, they were really interesting because I remember being at, I think it was RSA or Black Cat when Norse was kind of coming out and actually bumping into a Viking, like some dude dressed up as a Viking running around at Norse booth. And they had this super cool blinky light pew pew map thing that was over there. And everybody that was kind of on the non-technical cyber side was super interested in the pretty lights that were going on. But all of the practitioners and all of the other folks that kind of know what was actually making that work were kind of, sitting back going, something reeks of weirdness here. And the fact that it was getting crazy funding and there weren't a lot of buyers, but the valuation was going up. It, like you said, it was just this perfect storm of shenanigans, and it all came crashing down really fast. And the bad thing was that they actually had a line on a really useful product offering, but because of a combination of ignoring the market, ignoring feedback, not dealing with the market side of the equation, they got handed, they got their ass handed to them, and they went under, and they went under cataclysmically. So it was, to me, like in cyber, one of the best case studies of what not to do if you want to be successful.
Well, they had a good story also, right, underneath all of that, about the whatever it was, 100,000 sensors, honeypots all over the world, and the collectors inside the strategic Iranian locations and so forth. And that was feeding all of this. And it worked to the extent that, they were able to recruit some pretty good engineers and some pretty good analytical talent. Mary Landesman is one of the, in my estimation, is one of the best in the business before she retired. And she went over there and said, wow, this is fantastic shit. She wasn't, enamored, as you say, by the visuals as much as by the threat intelligence idea or ideal behind it, and wanted to contribute to that. As you say, they were on the brink of a great product, but as it turns out, it was just a bunch of lipstick.
Smoke and mirrors, yeah.
Yeah, so they certainly deserve what they got, but that also is a great illustration of venture money chasing businesses that without the kind of due diligence that you would expect of people investing $50 or $100 million.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling when you, because I wrote a chapter on that too about the whole VC game, because I found a lot of companies that I've consulted with that are small and startups, like they're not intimately familiar with the actual other side of the VC game. And it's not that they're necessarily malevolent or anything else, but they're out to make money. And if you're not prepared for the way that that's going to play out for your company, you're going to get gutted. They're very good at this, and it's not a place you want to be.
Yeah, well, and then kind of goes back to expect to get what you tolerate. I mean, if you don't understand the business model of the venture investor, then shame on you, I think, right? I mean, the business, it's not like anybody's hiding anything. They raise multiple funds. They have to spend those funds in order to raise additional funds. Those funds are locked at a certain number, 400 million, 800 million, whatever it happens to be. And then they go out and find investments for that 400 million and 800 million so that limited partners can get the kind of return in the kind of time frame that has been advertised, So, and no one, pretends that they're technologists, that they understand the actual nature of the companies in which they're investing. However, there is a level of diligence that you would expect.
There should be.
If you're a limited partner, certainly, and you're putting up your whatever return, your own pension fund or the pension fund you manage or the investment fund that you manage or your own money, in many cases, into these funds. But the whole purpose, it's a gambling business, right? I mean, you're betting on the roll of a dice that if it turns up, your number once out of 20 times, the return will be plenty to cover whatever the cost of the other 19 are, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's been this smile forever. So there's nothing wrong with, VCs, except when they try to pretend that they're something other than what they are.
That was on one other point that I kind of made in the book, because I learned this on my own going through some acquisitions and whatever, was that if you're a leader and you built this company and you've got VC money or whatever else, like there's things that will occur during that sort of transactional business that you should be aware of? Because, I mean, for me, and maybe it's just me, but ultimately, if I'm running a company, my goal is to take care of my employees first and foremost, not the VCs. And if you don't do it correctly, unfortunately, it's going to be those organizations that benefit. And I tell a story in this thing, literally about some in this book, about something that happened that I sat in on. And you watch the employees of the company, some of which could be there 2-3 decades, that don't get the return that they deserve because of their efforts. So it's like, I agree with you 1,000%. It's great that VCs have the money to do these things and that they invest. But if you're the business leader or the creator or the founder, and you're not familiar with how all this works, you're gonna get into a place where you might wind up accidentally, unintentionally screwing over your own employees, and no one wants to be that person.
No, you don't. But at the same time, you also, in order to retain that leadership position or role that you have, you have to represent the investor at the same time. And so, you know, by doing that, you may well plant that knife into the back of the 3-decade employee, and you kind of have to walk away from and say, hey, Anna, that's my job, like it or not. So yeah, it's a crappy business, that's for sure. What's a brilliant jerk?
Well, some folks would say that I am, but
I've never heard anybody say that.
I mean, I did a lot of reading into that and research into that, just because like Netflix has a great thing, and there's a book published about it called The No Asshole Rule. And where they're trying to get to is, it's okay to be really smart and be really good at what you're doing and be able to kind of tell people technically how to do things, because that's your thing. You're brilliant. But just because you're brilliant doesn't give you a right to be a jerk to anybody. And it's also for companies to know, you might not want to take that person who is the brilliant brain and parade them around as your kind of go-to-market face. There's some references I put in there and some stories around. There's people that are better off just kind of staying in the back and doing what they do and creating technology and running and leading. Don't think that you should make them someone that is a public-facing kind of go-to-market leader. They probably don't want to do it, even though they won't say it, and it's probably only going to hurt your brand and your position if you do shove those people out there, because their level of jerkiness will go up exponentially when they're doing things they don't want to do.
Yeah, certainly. What's a mushroom farmer?
So a mushroom farmer is actually a leader that keeps their people in the dark and occasionally feeds them some shit, and that is a very real thing that you see all the time. I've told a story in this book about some events I was involved in where that was the case. And it is painful to be on the mushroom farmed side of that equation. And the weird thing is, too, looking at the research, like there's a fine line between understanding what you should and shouldn't share with people to keep them in the light. And then there's also a way to make sure that you're dealing with not growing mushrooms, because what I learned from writing this book was mushrooms actually operate on this kind of cool substrata thing, fungi. It's the same thing when you think about a business and people. We talk to each other offline, we share things offline, we Slack, whatever, rumors, and that kind of feeds the growth of mushrooms, because there's not enough light and not enough good food to keep them doing the things that they ought to be doing. And it's a really interesting problem that can get really big really fast. If you've ever had one mushroom in your yard, you know, how fast do you have 50?
That's a good analogy. The money being the root of all evil is kind of a Captain Obvious statement, but you also indicate that it might yield success. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that goes back to the whole piece about how do you kind of grow your business with or without choosing to take funding. And I mean, I put some references in there and some personal stories about, like, there's a good way to kind of do the kill what you eat model, but there's also some logical and some intelligent decisions that businesses should make to figure out where they do decide to raise money. And if you are going to raise money, how should that feed that kill what you eat model, instead of what we typically see people do in technology is raise, and then try and sell and hope you've hit the numbers high enough that the valuation has a payout. And that seems to be kind of counter to what a lot of people think is the good way to do business. But the math and the data says that that's the smart way to grow your company.
Yeah. And we forget that people that run these businesses are like regular people like you and me, right? That we put our pants on one leg at a time and have the same range of IQ and EQ and brush our teeth a couple of times a day, you know? I mean, there's no real actual magic to this. And however, if you read a book called, you know, What Not to Do as a Leader, and you take that to heart, as I recommend folks do with your book, you're going to be way above the average player in whatever your space is. You talked in chapter 10 about choosing your horse wisely. What is that about?
Yeah. So I guess I put as many redneck references in this as I could.
Well, you did quite a few. That's right.
People, right? That's where I'm from. So and, yeah, I kind of talked about this whole idea of choosing your horse wisely. And I referenced a story from some people that lived down the road from me that the wife had a great idea to try and take thoroughbred racehorses and turn them into cattle horses. And they don't work well. So the whole point of it was basically to say, don't think that you can have someone who is a high performer, does really well with this one thing, and then take them and kind of chew on that square peg to make them fit into another opportunity or role, because it won't work right. They'll just get frustrated, and then you wind up with a crazy thoroughbred biting stuff and jumping over fences. And that's not what you want for your business. It's detrimental to the operational side. So you have to be very careful about the horses you choose and make sure that that is kind of what they're, quote, bred for.
Yeah, and that kind of goes hand in hand in a way with the brilliant jerk thing and kind of the way the Navy SEALs prefer or characterize those SEALs who succeed through SEAL training, which are not the smartest necessarily folks in that class, but they could be average smart, but they would be the most trustworthy. And so back to your point about currency early, trust is the number one currency for business leadership. It's also the number one currency to be a Navy SEAL, all other things equal. So what's a fatal funnel that I need to get past in change?
Yeah, so... I think a fatal funnel is a concept that people use in house clearing operations. So if you're going to go in and do hostage rescue or clear a house or whatever, you never want to get stuck in a doorway because the doorway is the fatal funnel. If you're going to get shot, that's kind of where it's going to happen. And the way that translates into business is don't get stuck trying to shove things through as fast as possible and sit there and look at the problem for too long. Your goal is to understand where you need to go and how you need to get there, and then get through it smartly, intelligently with people behind you that are going to make sure they cover your six, and then deal with the problems on the other side. Very often I've found organizations, and we've even heard the term, right, analysis paralysis, like that is very, very detrimental to executing on an objective, and you can't do that. It is where you will die as a business if you're stuck in that fatal funnel.
Yeah, good advice. Along with never letting your ego write checks your body can't cash, when you say don't lose perspective, what are you referring to?
Yeah, it's a common psychological, social thing where you see that people that wind up being CEOs and leaders, they kind of forget where they came from in a lot of instances. And in some instances, they never came from the ground troops. They just wound up kind of in a position. And they talk down to people. They don't treat them the way that they deserve to be treated. They're kind of up on high. And it's not good for a look. It hurts your trust. It hurts your respect, all those things that we talk about that are so critical. And you never want to let your ego write checks that you can't cash. And in this book, I give a really good story about someone that I personally dealt with that did this. And it's an interesting run through to kind of understand how your mouth can get you into trouble. And keyboard warriors are a very real thing in our space. Yeah. And you don't want to be one of those.
Yeah, right. So easy. It's so easy. Don't chase unicorns. Do you mean, that's chapter 13. Do you mean that don't try to become one? Is that advice here?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is a lot of folks go wrong with trying to get unicorn status. That's such a nice, you know, plaque to have on your wall or whatever, that we hit unicorn status. The businesses that have actually done it correctly, that have achieved that big goal, they never sat down and said, we're going to be a unicorn. They didn't chase unicorns. They just said, well, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we execute. And they continually innovated and grew. And then they hit unicorn status. And it's been a much more valuable journey for them on finances and company presence. So that's the whole thing is, don't chase them because they don't really exist. If it happens, it happens. But that should not be your goal as a leader.
Yeah. And in chapter 14, you talk about the microscope, telescope, and or mirror. What is that reference?
Yeah, so I think a lot of times people look in the wrong lens, and that was kind of what I put in there, was that there's the only lens that really matters is the mirror. You can look through a telescope, and a telescope also has lenses and mirrors and things like that, but it's really focusing you on a very specific problem, you know, with this sort of limited view. When in reality, if you looked in the mirror most of the time, you would see that the problem probably starts with you. And I mean, this is something that I personally do every day, is I look myself in the mirror and I ask me, my wife thinks I'm kind of nuts, like, what are you doing wrong? And if you do that, it actually, you know, take 3 seconds out of your day and do that. It's sometimes it's hard to look yourself in the mirror and really realize that you're doing something that's not going to help out. And that's the lens, in my opinion, that matters most.
Yeah, and that's a great exercise, and one we all should be doing every day. You're absolutely right. I'm conscious of the time here, Chase. We've got to wrap up here. I love that Wiley moves so quickly on this. I hope that it's successful, not just for them, but for you as well. My read of this book was highly enjoyable. You're an easy, very easy to read author, and your story's redneck or otherwise, you know. You might have noticed redneck is making something of a comeback here in this country. So that's not all bad, right? Your stories are fascinating and enjoyable. So I want to thank you for the book. And I urge people to, when it's available, or you can pre-order, I guess, right, on Kindle?
Yeah, you can pre-order. Yeah, it's out for pre-order now. And I hear that they are talking about doing an audiobook. So I guess I'm going to have to figure out how to start recording audiobooks.
Well, you've got such a crappy voice, you know. If you need me to do that for you, I'm more than happy.
All right, we'll work it out.
Yeah. All right. How Not to Lead by Dr. Chase Cunningham. Lessons every manager can learn from dumpster chickens, mushroom farmers, and other office offenders. So it's been a pleasure, Chase. Thanks for being on the show. And again, I wish you all the luck.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Sure. And thank you to our audience for spending some time with us today. And hopefully this was enjoyable to you as it was for me. And until next time, this is Steve King, your host, signing off.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Cybersecurity Insights. You can connect with us on LinkedIn or Facebook, or send us an email at social@cybered.io. For more information about the podcast, visit cybered.io/podcast. Until next week, stay safe and secure, and we'll see you on the next episode of Cybersecurity Insights.